parts. But nowhere else on earth has one lump of rock been left in such dramatic and solitary splendor, or assumed such a pleasing smooth symmetry. It is 100 million years old. Go there, man. Afterward, we had one last drive around the rock before heading back to the lonely highway. We had been at the site for barely 2 hours, obviously not nearly enough, but I realized as I turned around in my seat to watch it shrinking into the background behind us that there never could be enough, and I felt moderately comforted by that thought. Anyway, I'll be back. I have no doubt of that. And next time, I'm bringing a really good metal detector. Chapter 17. So we drove all the way back to Alice Springs. To compensate for our setback at Uluru, we decided to stay at one of Alice's fancy outlying resort hotels and hang the expense. Imagine then our surprise and gratification when we pulled into the oasis-like splendor of the Red Center Resort and discovered that it was $20 a night less than we had paid for much less at the Town Center Best Western the night before. This alone, we agreed at once, was almost worth a 600-mile drive. The Red Center was really just a very large motel with a bit of landscaping, but it was friendly and welcoming, and at its heart were a pool with a terrace and an adjoining bar and restaurant. Needless to say, this is where we were to be found 30 seconds after arrival. There we were told by the kindly staff that we were too late for dinner, but that they could probably rustle us up a couple of steak sandwiches or something. We told them we would be grateful for whatever they could give us, particularly if it was accompanied with drink. Then took a table by the pool's edge, where we sat watching the tranquil shimmer of the water and savoring the delightfully warm and wholesome desert air under a sky spread with stars. Suddenly, life seemed pretty good. Our driving was behind us now. We had seen Uluru, too briefly perhaps, but sufficient to appreciate its wonders. And here at the Red Center we appeared to have landed on our feet. Alan announced his intention to spend his final day in Australia sitting in a lounger beside the pool, reading inferior fiction and working on his tan. "How very shallow of you," I said. He accepted the criticism with imperturbable equanimity. "So you're not coming to see the desert park," I said. "Nope. Nor the telegraph station, nor the sand dune hall of fame, nor the fig farm. It's a date garden." A pause to stand corrected. "Nor anywhere else. I'm going to sit right here beside this pool and pass my day in a vain and idle manner. And you?" "I'm going to see the sights, of course," I said. "Well, then I will meet you afterwards and you can tell me all about it, no doubt in excruciatingly boring detail." "You can count on it," I promised. And so the following morning, I emerged from my room in a clean summer shirt, clutching a notebook with a pen tucked into the spiral, and went off in a dutiful frame of mind to see what Alice had to offer. I called first at the telegraph station, on a patch of sunny high ground a mile or so outside town. In its early days, Alice Springs was a repeater station, one of 12 between Darwin and Adelaide, which were needed to boost signals on their way across the country. What a forlorn and tedious existence that must have been, stuck in the middle of a suffocating nowhere, endlessly tapping out second-hand messages involving people you would never see or know, living in places you could only dream about. Outside the station was the reedy pool of water from which Alice Springs takes its name. The Alice in question was the wife of the director of telegraphs in Adelaide, and originally it was only the station that was called Alice Springs. The town that slowly rose in the valley below was called Stewart, after the explorer. For some reason, people found this confusing, and in 1933 the whole became known as Alice Springs. So the most famous town in the outback is named for a woman who had no connection with it and, as far as I know, never saw it. This done, I made a check beside Telegraph Station on my list of things to do, then drove on to the Alice Springs Desert Park. My expectations, frankly, were not high, but in fact it was splendid. It's run by the Parks and Wildlife Commission of the Northern Territory. What they have done is recreate over a large area three primary desert habitats, one that is very dry, one that gets a little moisture, and one that is normally dry but occasionally is swept by flash floods. This alone provided a worthwhile lesson. It makes you realize that deserts, in their quiet, arid way, are as varied as other environments. But I was also grateful to find various shrubs and other plants labeled and explained. It was a pleasure to be able to say, "Ah, so that's kangaroo paw. Well, I never. And let's see if this spinifex really does hurt as much as Ernest Giles said. Why, yes, it does." Scattered at intervals were large walk-in enclosures containing birds and other small desert animals, bandicoots and bush-tailed possums and so on, with labels detailing their habits. Best of all was a large nocturnal house where all manner of night creatures endlessly prowled and hopped and sniffed the air in a succession of nighttime dioramas. The display area was so faintly illuminated that it was actually possible to walk into walls and glass panels, but as my eyes slowly adjusted, I was able to pick out an amazingly diverse and rewarding range of small marsupials, potoroos and betongs and bilbies and numbats and quolls and much more. Because Australia is so vast and arid and difficult a landscape to study, and because the modest population base produces comparatively few scientists for the amount of ground to be covered, and because, above all, the animals within it are so often small, furtive, nocturnal, and sometimes mysterious, even now nobody really knows quite what is out there. Any list of Australian wildlife is arrestingly punctuated with qualified comments like "possibly extinct," or "thought to be endangered," or "may survive in some remote areas." The difficulties are well illustrated, I think, by the uncertain fate of the Ulacunta, or desert rat kangaroo. Nearly everything that is known about this interesting creature is owed to two men. The first was a 19th-century naturalist named John Gould, who studied and described the animal in 1843. It had, according to Gould, the shape and manner of a kangaroo, but was only about the size of a rabbit. What particularly distinguished it was that it could move at very high speeds for unusually long distances. Since that one initial report, however, the Ulacunta had not been seen. Enter Hedley Herbert Finlayson. Finlayson was a chemist by profession, but devoted much of his life to searching for rare native animals. In 1931, he led an expedition that traveled by horseback deep into the interior, to the perpetual furnace that is Sturt's stony desert. Upon arriving, Finlayson was surprised to discover that the little desert rat kangaroo, far from being on the verge of extinction or possibly gone altogether, was both visible and clearly thriving. The animal's speed and endurance were just as Gould had reported. Once, when Finlayson and his colleagues gave chase on horseback, a desert rat kangaroo ran 12 miles without pause through the searing heat of day, exhausting 3 horses in the process. Ounce for ounce, the little Ulacunta may well have been the greatest runner, or bouncer, actually, the animal kingdom has ever produced. Returning to society, Finlayson reported his exciting find, and naturalists and zoologists everywhere dutifully amended their texts to account for the desert rat kangaroo's rediscovery. Over the next 3 years, Finlayson made further expeditions, but in 1935, when he returned once more, he was nonplussed, as you may imagine, to discover that the little desert rat kangaroo had quietly vanished, as utterly as it had after Gould's single sighting in 1843. It hasn't been seen since. The chronicles of Australian fauna are amazingly full of stories such as this, of animals that are there one moment and gone the next. A more recent casualty of the phenomenon was a frog called Rio Batrachus silus, which was around for such a short time that it didn't even have time to attract an informal name. What was extraordinary about R. silus, and it almost goes without saying that there would be something, was that it gave birth to live young through its mouth, something never before seen in nature, inside Australia or out. It was discovered by biologists in 1973, and by 1981 had disappeared. It is listed as probably extinct. My favorite animal disappearance story, however, harks back to a somewhat earlier age. It concerns a 19th-century naturalist named Gerard Kreft, who in 1857 caught 2 very rare pig-footed bandicoots. Unfortunately for science and for the bandicoots, Kreft soon afterward grew hungry and ate them. They were, as far as anyone can tell, the last of the species. Certainly none have ever been seen since. Kreft, incidentally, was later appointed head of the Australian Museum in Sydney, but was invited to seek alternative employment when it was discovered that he was supplementing his salary by selling pornographic postcards. I am sure there must be a moral in there somewhere. From the desert park, I went to the Strelo Aboriginal Research Center. This was a quietly boring display concerning a man born on the Hermannsburg Mission, an Aboriginal reserve outside Alice, who devoted his life to studying Aborigines. He collected a huge stock of spiritual artifacts, but because they are sacred and not allowed to be seen by the uninitiated, they cannot be put on display. What you get instead are lots of old photographs of life at Hermannsburg, and more detail on the life and work of Theodore Strelo than a reasonable person could wish. However, as I was walking back to the car, I noticed a small aviation museum in an old hangar next door. Curiously, no one was in attendance, but the door was open, so I stepped inside and had a look around. The museum had a fairly predictable assortment of old engines and walls of yellowing photographs, but in a separate building there was something I had no idea still existed, and certainly never expected to see. No guidebook I have ever seen draws attention to it. Even the local tourism literature contained no hint that it is there. But for a few fretful days in 1929, it was the most famous and sought-after object in Australia. And here it was in a small aviation museum in Alice Springs, of all places. I refer to the remains of a light aircraft known as the Kookaburra, which went down in the desert while searching for a lost pilot named Charles Kingsford Smith. Kingsford Smith was not only the greatest Australian aviator of his age, but possibly the greatest aviator ever. He held more records than anyone else, and tackled infinitely more daring challenges. Just a year after Charles Lindbergh made his historic solo flight across the Atlantic, Kingsford Smith became the first to cross the Pacific, a far more ambitious enterprise, not simply because the scale was greater, but because flying conditions were much, much tougher and far less well understood. At the time of his Pacific attempt, only 10 months had passed since the first airplane had successfully flown to Hawaii in a race sponsored by a Hawaiian pineapple magnate, and that event had claimed the lives of 10 airmen. So when, in 1928, Kingsford Smith set off with a crew of 3 from San Francisco, aiming to reach Brisbane by way of Honolulu and Suva in Fiji, the undertaking was widely held to be impossible and insane, and so it nearly proved. 600 miles out from Hawaii, Kingsford Smith flew into a belt of meteorological liveliness known as the Intertropical Convergence Zone, an expanse of boiling clouds, towering storms, and the sort of winds that could blow a mustache off. As his small craft began to bounce about like some kind of elasticized toy, Kingsford Smith had no idea what to expect, or when it might end, because no pilot had ever flown into such a system before. This was, bear in mind, in a frail, spruce-framed, cloth-covered 1920s Fokker, so elemental in design that the seats weren't even bolted down. For hours, Kingsford Smith fought to hold the plane steady and in one piece. When at last it popped into clear air, he and his men were perilously low on fuel and faced with the problem of finding Fiji, a dot in an all but infinite ocean, before their engine ran dry and they fell into the sea. This and 100 other alarming obstacles Kingsford Smith tackled with courage, skill, resolution, and wit. Crossing the Pacific was possibly the most daring organized feat of aviation ever. Kingsford Smith always flew with a co-pilot, and generally with a navigator and radio man as well, so it is unfair to compare his achievements with the solitary heroics of Charles Lindbergh. Nonetheless, it is fair to observe that Lindbergh never flew through anything as ferocious as Kingsford Smith's Pacific storm. Indeed, after 1927, Lindbergh scarcely made another notable flight. Kingsford Smith, on the other hand, flew on and on, establishing records all over. He became the first to fly the Atlantic from east to west, again much tougher because it was against the jet stream, First to fly from Australia to New Zealand and back, and first to cross the Pacific in the other direction. He also held a fistful of records for fastest flights between Australia and England, and for various legs along the way. Which brings us to the Kookaburra. In March 1929, with a crew of three, Kingsford Smith set off to fly from Sydney to England. Over northwest Australia, along the Kimberley coast, they hit bad weather, grew hopelessly lost, not altogether surprisingly. For guidance, they had only a couple of Admiralty charts and a map of Australia torn from a standard Times Atlas, and made a forced landing on a coastal mudflat with almost no fuel left and hopelessly short of supplies. Almost all they had was a thermos of coffee and some brandy, which could be combined to make a drink called a coffee royal. Thus, what followed became known, somewhat darkly, as the Coffee Royal Affair. Luckily for Kingsford Smith, he and his men were in an area with plentiful fresh water and some adequate, if unappealing, sources of food, mud snails mostly. However, because the plane's radio was broken, they had no way of telling the outside world where they were. When news of the disappearance reached Sydney, two of Kingsford Smith's associates, Keith Anderson and Bob Hitchcock, decided to mount a rescue. In the little Kookaburra, they took off from Mascot Airport in Sydney, flew by stages to Alice Springs, and finally set off from there on what was supposed to be the final leg early on the morning of April the 12th, 1929. Soon afterward, while crossing the parched emptiness of the Tanami Desert, the area that Alan and I had skirted in the car on our drive from Daly Waters to Alice Springs, the engine began to sputter and backfire, and they were forced to make an emergency landing in the desert. In their haste to depart, they had packed no food and only 3 liters of water. Unlike Kingsford Smith, they landed in a place that offered no succor. They were dead by the third day. That is how unimaginably murderous the outback is. I don't wish to seem obsessive about this, but they drank their own urine too. Nearly everybody does who gets stuck in the outback. It's actually counterproductive because the salts in urine accelerate thirst. At almost the moment that Anderson and Hitchcock were wretchedly expiring, Kingsford Smith and his cronies were rescued by someone else. They returned to civilization looking so fit and rested that some people began to suspect, and some newspapers to speculate, that it had all been a publicity stunt. The whole thing grew rather ugly. Kingsford Smith was subjected to the humiliation of a public inquiry into his character. He was ultimately exonerated. Meanwhile, the nation waited breathlessly for news that Anderson and Hitchcock had been found alive. Alas, they were not. In late April, a search plane spotted the downed Kookaburra, with their bodies nearby, and a few days later a rescue party recovered the remains and brought them back to civilization. Hitchcock's family opted for a quiet funeral in Perth, but Anderson was given a state funeral of the most grave and magnificent pomp in Sydney. For days beforehand, people in the thousands stood in line for hours to view the coffin. On the day of the funeral, thousands more lined the streets to watch the cortege or gathered at the burial site. It was the biggest funeral in Sydney to that time, possibly the biggest ever. Today, it almost goes without saying, Anderson and Hitchcock are completely forgotten, inside Australia as well as out. So too, for a long time, was the Kookaburra. It sat in the desert, rusting and unnoted, for half a century before it was finally collected and taken to Darwin for restoration. About 10 years ago, it was placed in a special small building at the Aviation Museum at Alice Springs, where it appears to attract no attention whatever. Kingsford Smith returned to flying, setting yet more records. In 1935, while flying home from England, his plane crashed into the sea off Burma, taking him with it. Today he is fitfully remembered in Australia. Sydney's airport is named after him, and not at all elsewhere. In 1998, the American writer Scott Berg produced a 600-page doorstop biography of Charles Lindbergh, which naturally ranged over the whole story of aviation's early days. Of Charles Kingsford Smith, it contained not a mention. Alan and I dined that night on the patio of the Red Center, where I told him in great detail about my many exciting discoveries of the day. as we sat enjoying the warm evening and lazily finding our way to the bottom of our second bottle of very nice Western Australia Cabernet Sauvignon. As if on cue, a wallaby hopped up to the perimeter fence on the far side of the swimming pool, regarded us for a moment with a general air of unconcern, and began nibbling the shrubs that were planted there. It was the first time since my crossing of the country on the Indian Pacific many weeks earlier that I had seen a distinctive Australian animal in the wild. It was the first time Alan ever had, and he was thrilled. Whether for this reason or some other, he announced that he thought Australia a very fine place. "Do you?" I said, pleased, but just a little surprised, for he had seen little of it but desert. He leaned toward me very slightly and said, as if sharing a confidence, "It's very roomy." I looked at him. "Yes, it is. It's a very roomy country." On reflection, I think it may have been our third bottle. In the morning, I drove him to Alice's small but handsome airport, where we had a cup of coffee and sat quietly, for we were both a trifle hungover. I saw him to his gate, where we exchanged the usual rushed and fatuous expressions of thanks and goodwill, and he disappeared down the walkway. I watched him go, then turned and walked back to the car. I had a day to kill before flying on to Western Australia, and I wasn't at all certain how I was going to fill it. I headed into town for the business district, to find a bank machine and buy a newspaper. But en route I passed a sign for the School of the Air, down a side street, and impetuously I decided to have a look. I didn't expect a great deal, but it was terrific. What a lot of nice surprises Alice Springs was throwing up. The School of the Air was in an anonymous building on a residential street. It consisted of a reception area where the children's work was displayed on tables and around the walls, two small studios, a large meeting room, and that was about it. Although there are 17 Schools of the Air in Australia now, Alice Springs is the grandmother of them all and still covers the largest and emptiest area. It was a Saturday, so no lessons were in progress, but a very nice man was happy to show me around and tell me how it worked. The idea was simple enough, to provide formal schooling and some sense of classroom experience for kids growing up on cattle stations or other lonely spots, something it has been dutifully doing since 1951. Lonely is certainly the key word here. With a catchment area of 468,000 square miles, that is, an area roughly twice the size of France, the Alice Springs School has just 140 pupils spread between kindergarten and seventh grade. I retain a strangely vivid and influential memory of watching a film about it at school when I was 8 or 9, and of being extremely taken with the notion of being hundreds of miles from your teacher, entrusted with your own microphone and shortwave radio set, and free to sit there buck naked with a plate of cookies if you chose, since no one could see you. All of these seemed incalculable improvements on the situation that prevailed at Greenwood Elementary in Des Moines, Iowa. So the romance of radio learning has never quite left me. I was disappointed, therefore, to discover that the radio portion has never been more than a tiny and incidental part of the program. The School of the Air is, and always has been, essentially a correspondence course, which doesn't sound anything like as appealing. Even so, the place had a very real charm and air of goodwill. The bulletin boards were filled with illustrated essays from kids of about 11 describing life on their stations and what a typical day was like for them. I read every one with absorption. "Would you like to listen to a lesson?" the man in charge asked me. "Very much," I said. He took me into a side room and put on a tape recording of a day's lesson for 5-year-olds. It consisted mostly of a perky teacher going through the roll call, saying, "Good morning, Kylie. Can you hear me? Over." After a moment, there would be a faint crackle, as of a transmission from a very distant galaxy, and sounds almost recognizable as human speech, but much too indistinct to be deciphered. I say, "Good morning, Kylie. Are you there? Can you hear me? Over." This time there would be a pause and no response at all, just a rather poignant interval of dead air. Then, "Well, let's try Gavin, then. Good morning, Gavin. Are you there? Over." More crackle, and then a small, tinny voice would come back, "Good morning, Miss Smith." And so it went, with some voices coming in loud and clear, but many others fading in or out, or proving totally unreachable. As I listened to this, I also read a little book that I had bought, where I was frankly taken aback to discover that each child spends only half an hour a day, actually up to half an hour a day, on the radio, plus 10 minutes a week in a private tutorial with his or her teacher, hardly a lavish amount of personal attention. For the rest, they are expected to spend 5 or 6 hours a day working under the supervision of a parent or nanny. The students also make use of televisions, VCRs, and personal computers, but there wasn't evidence of this anywhere. The conclusion to which you are reluctantly but inescapably drawn is that it is forever 1951 at the School of the Air. The real surprise, however, was that there seemed to be no Aboriginal children involved. Certainly none were evident in the photographs. The population of the Northern Territory is about 20% Aboriginal overall, but in the far outback the proportion is much higher. I asked the man about that on my way out. "Oh, there are some," he said. "I'm not sure how many just at the moment, but there are a few. The problem is that the pupils have to be supervised by a competent adult, you see." I waited a moment, then said, "I'm sorry, I don't see." "They need a reliable, conscientious adult with core language and reading skills." "And Aboriginal parents don't have that?" I asked. He looked unhappy, as if this was a route we really shouldn't be traveling down. "No, I'm afraid not. Not always." "But if you're not giving the kids the lessons because the parents can't help them, then those kids, when they become parents, won't have the core skills either, will they?" "Yes, it's a problem," he agreed. "And so it will just go on forever?" "It's a very big problem." "I see," I said, though of course I didn't really see at all. Afterward, I continued into town. I bought a newspaper and took it to an open-air cafe on Todd Street, a pedestrian mall. I read for a minute or two, but then found myself just watching the passing scene. It was quite busy with Saturday shoppers. The people on the street were overwhelmingly white Australians, but there were Aborigines about, too. Not great numbers of them, but always there, on the edge of frame, unobtrusive, nearly always silent, peripheral. The white people never looked at the Aborigines, and the Aborigines never looked at the white people. The two races seemed to inhabit separate but parallel universes. I felt as if I was the only person who could see both groups at once. It was very strange. A very high proportion of the Aborigines looked beaten up. Many had puffy faces, as if they had wandered into a hornet's nest, and an almost absurdly high number sported bandages on shins, elbows, foreheads, or knees. A label at the Strello exhibition, which I had seen the day before, had been at pains to stress that the most ruined Aborigines were those one saw in towns. The idea, I guess, was to inform visitors like me that one shouldn't judge all Aborigines by these mild wrecks seen shuffling through the streets. Nonetheless, it struck me as an odd and paternalistic thing to say, in that it seemed to imply that Aborigines had two choices in their lives, to stay on the missions and prosper, or come into town and fall into penury and dereliction. It made me think of a line I had seen penned by a famous outback character named Daisy Bates, who came to Australia from Ireland in 1884, and for years lived among and studied the indigenous peoples of Western Australia. In The Passing of the Aborigines, published in 1938, she wrote, "The Australian native can withstand all the reverses of nature, fiendish droughts and sweeping floods, horrors of thirst and enforced starvation, but he cannot withstand civilization." In 1938, that may have qualified as sympathetic and enlightened comment, but it was disheartening to see it presented in modified form at an Aboriginal research center in 1999. You don't have to be a genius to work out that Aborigines are Australia's greatest social failing. For virtually every indicator of prosperity and well-being, hospitalization rates, suicide rates, childhood mortality, imprisonment, employment, you name it, the figures for Aborigines range from twice as bad to up to 20 times or more worse than for the general population. According to John Pilger, Australia is the only developed nation that ranks high for incidence of trachoma, a viral disease that often leads to blindness, and it is almost exclusively an Aboriginal malady. Overall, the life expectancy of the average Indigenous Australian is 20 years, 20 years, less than that of the average white Australian. In Cairns, quite by chance, I'd been told about a lawyer named Jim Brooks, who has worked for years for and with Aborigines, and I had managed to meet him for a cup of coffee in town, just before Alan and I had flown on to Darwin. A calm, easygoing, immediately likable man, with just a hint of the earnestness that must have led him to devote his working life to fighting for the disaffiliated, rather than piling up money in private practice. He runs the Native Title Rights Office in Cairns, which helps native peoples with land issues, and was one of the members of a human rights commission set up in the mid-1990s to investigate an unfortunate experiment in social engineering popularly known as the Stolen Generations. This was an attempt by government to lift Aboriginal children out of poverty and disadvantage by physically distancing them from their families and communities. No one knows the actual numbers, but between 1910 and 1970, between one-tenth and one-third of Aboriginal children were taken from their parents and sent to foster homes or state training centers. The idea, thought quite advanced at the time, was to prepare them for a more rewarding life in the white world. What was most amazing about this was the legal mechanism that enabled it to be done. Until the 1960s, in most Australian states, Aboriginal parents did not have legal custody of their own children. The state did. The state could take children from their homes at any time, on any basis it deemed appropriate, without apology or explanation. They did everything they could to eliminate contact between the parents and children, Jim Brooks told me when we met. We found one woman whose five children were sent to five different states. She had no way of keeping in touch with them, no way of knowing where they were, whether they were sick or well or happy or anything. Have you got kids? Four, I said. Well, imagine if a government van turned up at your house one day and some inspector came to the door and told you they were taking your children. I mean, seriously imagine how you would feel if you had to stand by and watch your children taken from your arms and put in a van. Imagine watching the van driving off down the road with your kids crying for you, looking at you out the back window, and knowing that you will probably never see them again. Stop, I said, with an uneasy stab at jocularity. He smiled sympathetically at my discomfort. And there is not a thing you can do about it. Nobody you can turn to, no court that will take your side. And this went on for decades. Why did they do it in such a heartless way? I asked. They didn't see it as heartless. They thought they were doing a good thing. He passed me a précis of the Rights Commission's report, which he had brought for me, and showed me a quotation from early in the century by a travelling inspector named James Isdell, who wrote of the dispossessed parents, "No matter how frantic their momentary grief might be at the time, they soon forget their offspring." They sincerely believed that Indigenous peoples were somehow immune to normal human emotions, Brooks said. He shrugged at the hopelessness of such thinking. Very often the children were told that their parents were dead, sometimes that their parents no longer wanted them. That was their way of helping them cope. Well, you can imagine the consequences. There was a lot of grief-related alcoholism, stratospheric levels of suicide, all that kind of stuff. What became of the kids, I asked. Well, the kids, meanwhile, were kept in care until they were 16 or 17, and then turned out into the community. They had a choice of staying in the cities and trying to cope with the inevitable prejudices, or returning to their traditional communities and resuming a way of life that they could barely remember with people they no longer really knew. The conditions for dysfunction and dislocation were bred into the system. You don't get rid of that overnight. You know, some people will tell you that the removal of children only affected a small proportion of Indigenous families. That is wrong. There was scarcely a family in the land that wasn't affected at some profound and immediate level. But even more tragically, it misses the point. Taking children away destroyed a whole continuity of relationships. Just because you stop that practice doesn't mean that all that damage is going to be magically undone and everything will be fine. So what can you do for them? I asked. Help to give them a voice, he said. That's all I can do. He shrugged a little helplessly and smiled. I asked him if there was still much prejudice in Australia, and he nodded. Huge amounts, he said. Really quite huge amounts, I'm afraid. Over the past 20 years, successive governments have done quite a lot, or quite a lot compared with what was done before. They have restored large tracts of land to Aboriginal communities. They have returned Uluru to Aboriginal stewardship. They have spent more money on schools and clinics. They have introduced the usual initiatives for encouraging community projects and helping small businesses get started. None of this has made any difference at all to the statistics. Some have actually gotten worse. At the end of the 20th century, an Aboriginal Australian was still 18 times more likely to die from an infectious disease than a white Australian, and 17 times more likely to be hospitalized as a result of violence. An Aboriginal baby remained 2 to 4 times more likely to die at birth, depending on cause. Above all, what is perhaps oddest to the outsider is that Aborigines just aren't there. You don't see them performing on television. You don't find them assisting you in shops. Only 2 Aborigines have ever served in Parliament. None have held a cabinet post. Indigenous peoples constitute only about 1.5% of the Australian population, and they live disproportionately in rural areas, so you wouldn't expect to see them in vast numbers anyway. But you would expect to see them sometimes, working in a bank, delivering mail, writing parking tickets, fixing a telephone line, participating in some productive capacity in the normal workaday world. I never have, not once. Clearly some connection is not being made. As I sat now on the Todd Street Mall with my coffee and watched the mixed crowds, happy white shoppers with Saturday smiles and a spring in their step, shadowy Aborigines with their curious bandages and slow, swaying, knocked-about gait, I realized that I didn't have the faintest idea what the solution to all this was, what was required to spread the fruits of general Australian prosperity to those who seemed so signally unable to find their way to it. If I were contracted by the Commonwealth of Australia to advise on Aboriginal issues, all I could write would be, do more, try harder, start now. So without an original or helpful thought in my head, I just sat for some minutes and watched these poor disconnected people shuffle past. Then I did what most white Australians do. I read my newspaper and drank my coffee and didn't see them anymore. Chapter 18. Consider the platypus. In a land of improbable creatures, it stands supreme. It exists in a kind of anatomical netherworld, halfway between mammal and reptile. 50 million years of isolation gave Australian animals the leisure to evolve in unlikely directions, or sometimes scarcely to evolve at all. The platypus managed somehow to do both. When word reached England in 1799 that there existed in Australia a toothless, venomous, fur-covered, egg-laying, semi-aquatic animal with a duck-like bill, the tail of a beaver, feet that were both webbed and clawed, and a strange orifice called a cloaca, which served both reproductive and excretory purposes, a feature, as one taxonomist delicately noted, that was highly curious but not well adapted for popular details, it was received, not altogether surprisingly, as a hoax. Even after a careful examination of a shipped specimen, the British Museum's anatomist, George Shaw, found it impossible not to entertain some doubts as to the genuine nature of the animal, and to surmise that there might have been practiced some arts of deception in its structure. According to the natural historian Harriet Ritvoe, the original specimen still bears the scissor scars where Shaw snipped and fiddled to determine whether a hoax had been perpetrated. For most of the next century, scientists argued, and argued heatedly, for it was an age obsessively devoted to exactitude, over how to classify the animal, before putting it and its cousin the echidna, a creature similar to a hedgehog, in a family of their own, the monotremes. The name means one whole, in reference to the distinguishing cloaca. Unresolved, however, was the question of whether the monotremes were to be regarded as primarily mammal or reptile. It was evident from their peculiar anatomy that monotremes laid eggs, a reptilian trait, but it was equally evident that they suckled their young, a mammalian characteristic. A further vexation was that for almost a century nobody could find a monotreme egg. So we may envision the murmur and buzz that swept the auditorium when, in 1884, at a meeting of the British Association, the delegates were read a cable just arrived from a young British naturalist in Australia named W. H. Caldwell. Caldwell's message in full read, Monotremes oviparous, ovum meroblastic. Well, the murmurs were prodigious, the buzz electric. What Caldwell was announcing with such elegant pith was that he had found platypus eggs, and they were unquestionably reptilian in nature. In the end, Caldwell's find didn't make a lasting difference. The monotremes ended up in the mammalian camp, though for a while it was a close-run thing. I mention all this to give a little context to the very real excitement I felt the following day when, freshly arrived in Perth, I happened upon a monotreme of my own, an echidna crossing a path in a lonely corner of King's Park. I was already, I have to say, in pretty high spirits. Perth is a lovely city and one of my favorites in Australia. I have perhaps an inflated fondness for it because on my first visit there, in 1993, I arrived by way of Johannesburg, where I had just been robbed in a fairly hair-raising manner, in broad daylight in the city center, by a party of cheerfully menacing youths with twitchy knives, and it was such a relief to find myself in a city where I could wander without fear that I might be bundled into an alley, liberated of my possessions, and liberally incised with sharp instruments. Even without arriving fresh from an incident of criminal excitement, Perth is a cheery and welcoming place. There is, first of all, the delight in finding it there at all, for Perth is far and away the most remote big city on earth, closer to Singapore than to Sydney, though not actually close to either. Behind you stretch 1,700 miles of inert red emptiness all the way to Adelaide. Before you, nothing but a featureless blue sea for 5,000 miles to Africa. Why 1.3 million members of a free society would choose to live in such a lonely outpost is a question always worth considering. But climate explains a lot. Perth has glorious weather, good-natured weather, the kind that sets the postman to whistling and puts a spring in the step of delivery people. Architecturally, Perth has no particular distinction. It is a large, clean, modern city, Minneapolis down under. But its sharp and radiant light makes it a beauty. You will never see bluer city skies or purer sunlight bouncing off skyscrapers than here. But what especially sets Perth apart is the possession of one of the world's largest and finest parks, King's Park. Spread across 1,000 comely acres on a bluff above the broad basin of the Swan River, King's is all those things a city park should be. Playground, sanctuary, strolling area, botanical garden, vantage point, memorial. And so big that you can never feel as if you have seen it all. Most of it is arrayed in a conventional manner. Undulant lawns, paths, flower beds. But a substantial corner, constituting perhaps a quarter of the whole, has been left as unimproved bush. It was while strolling down a sunny path through this little-visited zone that I saw a small furry hemisphere, rather like the brush portion of a floor polisher, emerge from the undergrowth on one side of the path and proceed with a stately lack of haste toward identical undergrowth on the other side. Sensing me, it stopped. It had glossy black quills pointing straight back and had curled itself roughly into a ball, so I couldn't see its pointy snout, but it was clearly an echidna. It could be nothing else. I couldn't have been more thrilled. It was a little pathetic, I grant you, when you consider that this was my most exciting moment of engaging a creature in the wild in Australia. In a country filled with exotic and striking life forms, my high point was finding a harmless, animated pincushion in a city park. I didn't care. It was a monotreme, a physiological anomaly, a wonder of the reproductive world, an oddity from the loneliest branch on the mammalian tree. When the echidna sensed that I had retreated to a respectful distance, it unfurled and continued on its waddling way into the bush. Thrilled to my cloaca, I followed the path around and back into the park proper, where I came, after some time, to a long, lovely avenue of tall white gum trees planted long ago to commemorate the fallen of World War I. Each tree bore a small plaque, giving bare details, unexpectedly moving when read one after another down a long walk of an abbreviated life. In honor of Captain Thomas H. Bone, 44th Battalion, said one. Killed in action, Passchendaele, 4th October, 1917, aged 25. Dedicated by his wife and daughter. It is a fact, little noted outside Australia, and I think worth at least a mention here, that no other nation lost more men as a proportion of population in World War I than Australia. Out of a national population of under 5 million, Australia suffered a staggering 210,000 casualties, 60,000 dead, 150,000 injured. The casualty rate for its soldiers was 65%. As John Pilger has put it, no army was as decimated as that which came from farthest away, and all were volunteers. Only a few days earlier, in one of the weekend papers, I had read a review of a new history of World War I by the British historian John Keegan. In passing, the reviewer had noted, with an all but palpable sigh, that Keegan's 500 pages of densely observed text had failed to include a single mention of the Australian forces. Poor Australia, I thought. Other countries produce unknown soldiers. It produces unknown armies. Weeks later, in London, I checked the Keegan book, and it was full of references to the Australian army. The conclusion to draw from this, I guess, is that Australians so expect to be overlooked that they sometimes overlook not being overlooked, so to speak. Beyond this somber avenue lay the much perkier and sunnier realm of the botanical gardens, and this I approach now with unusual devotion, for Australia's plants are exceptional, and there is no place where you will find them more handsomely displayed. Australia really is the most amazingly fecund country. It is thought to contain something on the order of 25,000 species of plants. Britain, for purposes of comparison, has 1,600 species. But that's really only a guess. At least a third of what is out there has never been named or studied, and new stuff is turning up all the time, often in the most unlikely places. In 1989, in Sydney, for instance, scientists found an entirely new species of tree called Alocasuina portuensis. People had been living around these trees for 200 years, but because they weren't very numerous, just 10 have been found, no one had noticed them before. In much the same way, in 1994 in the Blue Mountains, some botanist out for a walk happened on another of those unexpected relic species long presumed to be extinct. Called Wollemi pines, these were not modest shrubs hidden among tall grasses, but stout and imposing trees up to 130 feet tall and 10 feet around. It's just that with such a lot of land to survey, and only so many botanists to go around, it took a while for the two to intersect. Nobody can guess, of course, what else might be out there awaiting discovery. This is, of course, what makes Australia such a fundamentally exciting place to engage in the natural sciences. In Britain or Germany or America, you might, with great luck, find a new strain of mountaintop lichen or some sprig of previously overlooked moss. But in Australia, take a stroll through the bush, and you can find half a dozen unnamed wildflowers, a grove of Jurassic angiosperms, and probably a 10-kilo lump of gold. I know where I'd be working if I were in science. The question that naturally occurs in all this is why Australia, which so often seems singularly hostile to life, has produced such an abundance of it. Paradoxically, half the answer lies in the very poverty of the soil. In the temperate world, most plants can prosper in most places. An oak tree can grow as productively in Oregon as it can in Pennsylvania, and so a relatively few generalist species tend to predominate. In poor soils, on the other hand, plants are driven to specialize. One species will learn to tolerate soils containing, say, high concentrations of nickel, an element that other plants find distasteful. Another will become tolerant of copper. Yet another might learn to tolerate nickel and copper, and perhaps prolonged drought as well. And so it goes. After a few million years, you end up with a landscape filled with a great variety of plants, each favoring very specific conditions, and each master of a patch of ground that few other plants could abide. Specialized plants lead to specialized insects, and so on up the food chain. The result is a country that seems on the face of it hostile to life, but in fact is wonderfully diversified. The second, more obvious factor in Australia's variety is isolation. 50 million years as an island clearly sheltered indigenous life forms from a great deal of competition, and allowed certain of them, eucalypts in the plant world, marsupials in the animal world, to prosper uncommonly. But no less important, in terms of species diversity, is the isolation that has long existed within Australia. In general terms, Australia comprises scattered pockets of life separated by great zones of harshness. And nowhere is all this more true than in southwestern Australia. According to David Attenborough, in The Private Life of Plants, this one corner of Australia contains no less than 12,000 different plant species, and 87% of them grow nowhere else in the world. Which makes it alarming to report that many of these singular plants are in trouble from a terrible and little understood malady called dieback. Dieback comes from a fungus genus called Phytophthora, which is related to the fungus that caused the potato blight in Ireland. It has been in Australia for a century and has affected plants all over the country, though the source wasn't identified by science until 1966. It is especially a worry in southwest Australia, partly because it thrives there as nowhere else, and partly because the southwest has such a density of rare and vulnerable plants. I discovered now, from an informative signboard, that even Banksias are under threat. The Banksia, named for its discoverer, Joseph Banks, is perhaps the most adored flower in Australia. It's a bit of an oddity. The flowers look uncannily like toilet brushes, but Australians love it because it is striking, and it is everywhere, and it is theirs alone. So it was discouraging to read that 7 species of Banksia are on the endangered list and could well become extinct in the wild in the next few years. 12 more species are under threat. Perhaps it's my natural pessimism, but it seems that an awfully large part of travel these days is to see things while you still can. The most disturbing thought of all, I suppose, is that with so much still unrecorded, many plants could disappear before they are even found. All this was of some moment because I was about to go off on a small botanical quest of my own. First, however, I had a day at leisure in Perth. I had nothing very particular in mind, but a few minutes later, as I sat on the shady terrace of the park's central cafe, decorating my face with a chocolatey froth of cappuccino and reading the West Australian newspaper, I came upon a news article that planted the possibility of an idea. The article was to do with a man named Lang Hancock, about whom I had lately been reading. Hancock was a rancher in the remote north of Western Australia, who had the exceptional good fortune to be at the heart of one of the greatest mineral booms in modern history. Anyone who doubts that Australia truly is a lucky country has only to review the story of the country's mineral discoveries in the 1950s and a little beyond. Up until that time, conventional wisdom held that Australia was deficient in almost all natural resources. Iron ore, for instance, was considered to be in such short supply that for 2 decades it was illegal to export it. Then in 1952, Lang Hancock made an important discovery. While piloting a light aircraft over the trackless emptiness of the Hamersley Range near the north coast, he lost his bearings in a sudden storm and made a forced landing in a zone of flat rock known to geology as the Western Shield. Stepping from his airplane, he realized that he was standing on almost solid iron. Looking into the matter further, he discovered that he owned a 100-kilometer-long block of nearly solid iron ore. From almost nothing in 1950, Australia's estimated reserves of iron ore rose to 20 billion tons in 1960. By the end of the 1960s, Hancock alone controlled iron ore reserves greater than those of the United States and Canada combined. That is a lot of iron ore. But it was only the beginning. In dizzying succession, mineral deposits were found all over the place. Bauxite, nickel, manganese, uranium, copper, lead, diamonds, tin, zinc, zircon, rutile, ilmenite, and many others that most of us have never heard of. Almost overnight, people with mining interests made fortunes that were embarrassing to contemplate and impossible to spend. The stock markets went crazy as investors scrambled to grab a piece of the action. In Sydney, one broker lost an ear, in the frenzied trading that accompanied the constant reports of new discoveries. It was a heady period, and it transformed Australia's fortunes. From a sleepy, good-natured producer of wool, it became a mining colossus, the world's biggest exporter of minerals. As many of the biggest finds were in Western Australia, much of the wealth settled in Perth, the state capital, which is what accounts for all its skyscrapers. Lang Hancock, the man who started it all, was called to the great Iron Mountain in the sky in 1992. But in his dotage, it appears, he did that thing that brings dread to the hearts of rich children everywhere. He married his housekeeper, a lady from the Philippines named Rose. According to the morning paper, Hancock's daughter had filed a lawsuit alleging that the widow Rose and the late Mr. Hancock had lavishly and improperly spent money that was not their own. Helpfully, the article provided a sidebar in which Mrs. Hancock's principal assets were listed. These included a $35 million house in a Perth suburb called Mossman Park, complete with the address. It was, apparently, the grandest residence in the city. The chandeliers alone had cost $3 million. Looking at my map of the city, I realized that Mossman Park was at the far end of a clutch of famously well-heeled suburbs running all the way out to Fremantle. And as it was a fine day and I was feeling perky, I decided to walk out. Well, it's a long way from Central Perth to Mossman Park and beyond, that's all I'm saying. I walked for hours through the leafy sprawl of the University of Western Australia campus and around the sunny foreshore of the Swan River estuary, tracing the sweep of sunny bays and yacht-cluttered coves, and made my way at length into residential zones of startling showy wealth, Nedlands, Dalkeith, Peppermint Grove, where palatial houses basked in the penetrating sunshine. These neighborhoods went on for miles, just street after foot-wearying street of trophy homes, with big gates beside broad drives, patios adorned with Grecian urns on ornate plinths, and garages for fleets of cars. It was a stunning demonstration of the proposition that money and taste don't always, or even often, go together. These were the houses of lottery winners, of retailers of the sort who appear in their own television commercials, of people for whom the words Peppermint Grove in an address would not be an embarrassment. I would not suggest for a moment that Australia's nouveau riche are more distant from refinement than the people of other lands, but the absence of a distinctive architectural vernacular in Australia does mean that people can take their styles from a wider range of sources, principally drive-in banks, casinos, upmarket nursing homes, and ski lodges. To see it massed over a spread of miles, as in the western suburbs of Perth, is certainly an absorbing experience. I had been walking for nearly 3 hours when I arrived at a landmark called Chidley Point and realized I had found Mossman Park. I delved in my bag for the newspaper to check the address and discovered that I had evidently left it on the table at the cafe in King's Park. Never mind. I had walked 8 or 9 miles by now and had seen enough extravagant real estate to last me a lifetime. I vaguely recalled the Hancock House as being on Wellington Street, so I found my way to this sedate thoroughfare and strolled along it. En route, I saw perhaps 8 houses that looked as if they might contain many $1 million worth of bricks, mortar, garden ornaments, and tinkling chandeliers, but nothing that announced itself unequivocally as the grandest pile in the metropolis. As I stood there, a young woman in shorts and a matching top, a professional dog walker, I supposed, came along behind a frisky dog not much smaller than a pony. She wasn't so much walking the dog as skiing behind it on the soles of her shoes. I stepped into the street to keep from being eaten, but asked as she passed if she knew the Hancock House, and she pointed to a place about 3 doors up. I went and had a look. Considering the cost, I have to say I had expected rather more. A sort of San Simeon meets Liberace's dream mausoleum is what I believe I had in mind. But this was on a smallish lot and was neither particularly tacky nor outstandingly ornate. I studied it for a few minutes, struck by the somewhat tardy thought that although I had voluntarily invested a good deal of exertion to get here, I didn't actually care in the tiniest degree where Rose Hancock dwelled. This notion absorbed, I turned with a thoughtful countenance and continued on my long march to the sea. Although Fremantle, population 24,000, is now effectively just a coastal suburb of Perth, historically it is a separate community and ferociously defends its independent identity. You will even sometimes see it characterized as Perth's sister city. Certainly it has a quite separate feel to it. In Gold Rush days it was a port of cosmopolitan liveliness, but then it sank into a long period of decrepitude. In the 1970s, it underwent a gentrifying revival as people realized the commercial potential of its large stock of neglected Victorian buildings. So today it is a trendy hangout, a place of latte and gelato, and little shops selling things of an arty nature. Everybody is fond of Frio, as they call it. So am I, normally, though my enthusiasm